My name is Rachel. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is June 23rd of 2005. I have a home group and a sponsor. Thank you very much, Sam, for asking me to come out tonight. And thanks to my sponsor who recommended me. I would never have said no to begin with, but, you know, I'm glad that she suggested me and that I was able to come out here and share my story with you guys. So I am just going to share my experience with alcoholism and share my experience being sober. All I have is my experience. I really hope that you relate. If you don't and you're new, please keep coming back and, you know, perhaps you won't relate to the specific details of my story, but I hope that you relate to how I drank and my relationship with alcohol. And the feelings that are behind that, you know, that was, you know, I'll get into it in a bit, but that was what kept me coming back here was how much I related. You know, I had gone to a meeting of another fellowship, and right when I got out of detox, I went to, I'll just make it clear, I went to an NA meeting, and somebody sat me down and tried to 12-step me, and they said, you know, they shared their experience about smoking like $10,000 worth of crack in a month. And I love to smoke crack. And my reaction to that person was, I'm really glad that you're here. I went to an AA meeting and people started talking about their drinking. They started talking about, the effect that alcohol has on them. They started talking about the insanity. And they said, when I started drinking, they can't stop. And that was alcoholism. And I felt like that explains a lot, actually. Because I was, you know, I didn't think when I came into AA I was an alcoholic. I thought that that was a bit dramatic. But I knew that there was a fire under my butt that that there was something wrong, and I had desperately been trying to stop drinking on my own and couldn't do it. So, and people had forever been telling me, when you drink to excess, like, all the time. They would be like, this one girl I remember one time saying to me, she was like, I can have a drink, and I can have a couple, and get a good buzz, and stop. And then she would point to me, and she'd be like, you cannot do that. And I was like, I don't see what the problem is, you know. I did not understand having one or two and then going about my life. I feel like it is hardwired in my DNA to drink that way. So just to make that very clear, I hope that you relate to that. You might not, again, you might not relate to the specific details of how I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I do hope that you relate to that. So I'm going to, you know, get started on my story. I was born. Alcoholism is on my dad's side, really bad. His father and other family members were horrible, violent drunks. I mean, and I was never exposed to this. I never met my grandfather. My dad, when my grandfather died, and his dad was on his deathbed, my dad said, I do not want to see this man. And my mom's side of the family is crazy. And they came together, and here I was, you know. Thank God you're laughing. I always feel like when people don't laugh, it means you're just like, oh, I'm burying my soul, and you're not laughing at me. It just kind of makes you feel judged, you know. But I, you know, I from my earliest moments felt uncomfortable. And I feel like when I first came into AA, I was a victim, you know. Everything was my dad's fault, and it was sex tape guy's fault, which I'll get to later. And I remember looking at the A step, and or the eighth and ninth step, and seeing where it said making amends, and I thought, like, wow, people really need to make amends to me, you know. And I feel like being in AA for a little bit, your story, it's almost like your perception changes, and I can see now where, you know, certain things that happened that probably weren't the best of circumstances, but I was just, you know, it wasn't always everybody was against me, you know. I was just so uncomfortable, and there's no real reason for that other than some kind of giant hole in me, you know. And my first instinct when I was younger was hide that. Like, I am weird and I need to hide this by all means possible and make it look like I have got it together. And that did not work. Oh my God. It was just like, just got tighter and tighter and tighter. And I would have these kind of very belligerent outbursts, you know, at a very young age. Like, I would call, you know, some kid a bastard in school, and they'd be like, do you know what that means? You are not young enough, or you're not old enough to know what that means. And I'd be like, I don't know. I just said it. I don't know. I was just so, so tightly wound. And I remember, like, I just hated people. I hated people, and I was so desperate for their approval. And that is exhausting. and I was just very, very much like, you know, someone, please, you know, give me attention. I remember I was terrified to call people. I remember I would be so excited about having a sleepover with, you know, a friend, but then I would get terrified about the fact that I would then have to entertain them. And just the actual thought of having a conversation with somebody, it just overwhelmed me. I was just, when push came to shove, I was like, I just want to be left alone all by myself. You know, not have to talk to anybody. It's draining. It's exhausting. I'm nervous about what I'm going to say. I did not play well in the sandbox with others. I mean, I was constantly fighting some, like, I just do not have normal reactions to life at all. And I was just constantly fighting somebody. And that does not make me alcoholic. Not one bit. That just makes me weird. What makes me alcoholic is, you know, what alcohol does for me, what it does for that, you know. And I really feel like I needed a drink. I desperately needed something, like whatever it was. I was like, I just needed something to make me feel better, you know. And I remember going to church when I was very young. And I remember I, like, was at church one day, and there was this guy from, like, he was like a former Hell's Angels. And him talking to me about God, and he was like, you know, God and the church saved my life. I'm so grateful to be alive. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, there was no connection to a God. I mean, certainly there was. I went to church camp, you know, really, really wanted this, I feel like I wanted what these people had, but I also, like any grouping, I didn't feel a part of. So when I don't feel a part of something, I hate it. I just felt like I don't understand this connection that you have with people, with the world, with this God you speak of. Like, I don't get it. But I remember trying to act like I did. And that's all I wanted. I was a seeker. I was seeking something. And I found that in alcohol. I cannot stress that enough, you know. And the first time that I got drunk, I remember drinking before this, and I even remember doing something a little, like, I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember looking around and being drunk and feeling like, I'm just embarrassing myself, aren't I? And feeling like people weren't going to want to talk to me the next day. That's the only memory I have of this. But this is the first time where I can, like, look, I can see what our book describes as the phenomenon of craving. I feel like that was really fancy language when I was new. I, like, once I start drinking, I'm unable to stop. That, you know, phenomenon, I was like, that is really big words you're using, guys, please. You know, so I like that. And when somebody said that to me, I was like, yes, absolutely. I fall into that category. People have been yelling at me about this for a while now. You know, but I went with a couple of friends over to this guy's house. And I remember just feeling so uncomfortable when I walked in. And they had a handle of Bacardi because, you know, young high schoolers trying to, I don't know, do whatever. And I just started, I just started drinking. And I remember taking one shot, and it's like a light, it's like some kind of switch goes off inside me that's like, you must drink to excess, period. I feel like in my story, like, I don't ever really remember trying to go out and have one or two. And I feel like I don't need that to know I'm alcoholic. I feel like what really got me is later on in my drinking when I tried to stop on my own and I couldn't. That was what made me feel absolutely insane. But, you know, again, just, I mean, I was just knocking them back, and I'm little now, but I was really little. I was young and I was little. And, you know, I like to consider that night a warm-up for the years to come. I landed in the shower with the guy whose house we were at, who I had never met before that day. I was given a very nasty nickname, and I was told that I should never drink ever again. And I vaguely remember, like, my mom coming to pick me up, and I am assuming that they called her, and I was told I was, like, shaking and maybe going into convulsions or something like that. I don't remember. It sounds a little dramatic, but I don't remember that. But I'm assuming that they called my mom, and I remember being so drunk and just tumbling down this hill, and her just being like, get in the car. And she took me back to my house, and her and my dad were lecturing me on the kitchen table. And I felt like, you guys are really ruining this for me, because I was having that effect from alcohol. And I, you know, finally they were done. I went upstairs. I would get so hungover. Jeez, oh my goodness. I would be throwing up, hugging the toilet. I would say bath, I'd throw up in the bath. I was a mess when I drank. And, you know, I was so sick, and I remember I had fallen in love with this song earlier in the day, and it took every ounce of strength in my body to, like, turn to my CD player and try to put it on repeat, because I wanted the moment to be perfect, because I felt really good, and there's no reason I should have felt that way given the events of the night. It was really bad, but I feel like, of all the things that I did, alcohol was the thing that kind of shut off the head, and that was what I was looking for. And, I remember the next day I was on, like, four-way. I don't even know if you can do this anymore, but we had a landline, and we were talking on four-way, and they were like, this is fine, that was bad, just don't ever drink ever again. Like, just don't do it. Like, clearly you can't handle it. And on the outside, I was like, yes, absolutely, I'm still pretty sick. This wasn't my finest moment. I'll give you that. But on the inside, I felt like, you are crazy if you feel like I'm never going to do that ever again, if you think I'm never going to do that ever again. And there was just, there was no stopping me. And if there was ever a pinnacle in my drinking, that was it. You know, I feel like the best I was ever able to obtain, feeling a part of wise, was just like a nervous wreck. And when I look, that's kind of when I was, just like a nervous wreck. I would go over, it was the summer, I would go over to these people's house, like these girls' house, we would hang out all the time. I didn't like it when other people, like when school year finally started, I was like, oh my God, I don't want people hanging out with us, you know, like, I just wanted to feel better, and I wanted people to make me feel better. What changed for me, you know, my drinking after that was sporadic. I don't think that anything like the actions would, like something like that would occur, but when I would drink, it would very much disturb others. Like, I would be the girl that would get drunk. I would throw up on your couch. I would get bruises. I would embarrass you. And I just remember one day, like, going shot to shot with a friend of mine and her looking at me and just being like, she didn't even have to say it. Her face just said, like, I cannot do what you're doing. Like, I just, like, physically I can't. She went off. I got drunk. Like, they just couldn't handle it. And when you get that drunk, you are annoying. I feel like alcohol took away a lot of the fear that I had about things. So a lot of things that I maybe was afraid to say or was afraid to do, I would do. Again, that caused more problems. Sorry, it gets really hot when you get nervous. What changed from it becoming this kind of sporadic drinking to, you know, making a conscious decision of, I'm going to drink so I don't have to feel this way anymore, was, there was a guy. There's always a guy. And I had really made my world revolve around him for like 2 years. And I feel like the best way to sum this up is, you have never seen anybody with lower self-esteem in a situation. And, you know, just to give you an idea of what this was like, I bought him tickets to a Dallas Redskins game for Christmas, and he took his other girlfriend, who was pregnant with his child. He tried to run my mother over with a car. I had previously mentioned a sex tape incident. I was very young, and, you know, I was under the age of 18, and I made a mistake, and, you know, did that. And then, you know, this is the days before Facebook and YouTube, if there was ever a silver lining. But, you know, the way you made something viral back then was you showed it to everybody, and he sure did. And you know, I found out about that. And I remember I was actually on something else when I had found that out. But I remember sometimes I think the mind is like, I think that the mind can kind of shut down when you really need it to. And that was what happened for me. I just kind of stuffed that back, you know. But that, like, all of this was happening. There was an incident in my cafeteria. I had gotten suspended from school. That is restraining order number one, that incident. And, you know, and I was told that I could not come back to school unless I sought some kind of psychiatric evaluation. Because of that, I ended up going to a community college for my senior year of high school, not because I'm smart, but because they didn't want me there and I didn't want to be there. So, you know, all of this was happening around this time, and I was just like, I need something to fix this. And I knew that alcohol did that. And I also went to other substances as well. We have a primary purpose here, and I really try to respect that. So I'm not going to go into too much detail about that, but I do feel like it got me in here a lot faster. You know, I have 12 years sober. You know, I'm 31. I help you with the math. I was 19. And I feel like, you know, I never when I came into AA, I did not think, like, I'm too young to be in AA. You know, I felt like it was just really bad. And I feel like the, you know, drugs got me here a lot faster. It would have happened eventually, but, you know, I just dealt with it the best way I knew how, and I went all in. And again, I didn't have much going on. I had my crappy part-time job at Abercrombie, and I got fired. I actually got fired everywhere that I worked. There is this road called Rockville Pike, and there's a bunch of restaurants on Rockville Pike in Montgomery County. And I worked at every restaurant that was there in the early 2000s. I worked there, and I got fired. I got fired from Hooters. You have no idea how hard that is to do. I remember I had to fill out a background, I went through a background investigation for my job, and I had to fill out the form, and like, it's like, why did you, like, what happened? Why did you leave here? And I'm like, you have to say you got fired. And then they want to know the reason why. And I wanted to say to the people, like, if you find out, can you please tell me? I have no idea. You know, I just really don't know, but obviously it didn't work out. And obviously I did something. You know, so I was, you know, I was kind of blessed with this gift of nothing going on. I had these, you know, two community college classes that I was taking. You know, I barely showed up for them. I remember my history teacher, I would just go in and say that I had to work all the time, and that's why I either wasn't showing up or was falling asleep in class. He gave me a B. The other class was like health, you know, like it was just, I had nothing going on. I dedicated my life to drinking. And thank God for people who want to drink on a Tuesday. You know, thank God for people who want to do drugs on a Tuesday. I feel like, I don't know about every night, but it was almost every night I was just out there. You know, I feel like that was how I lived, and I felt like a geographic might be helpful. So, wow, 6:22, I should probably hurry up so I can get sober. What happened was I had always felt like if I could just kind of get out of Dodge, then things would be okay. And that opportunity presented itself in the form of college. I didn't get very far. I went to Frostburg, which is a college up in, I think it's Western Maryland, I think. And, you know, I didn't get in anywhere else. I didn't really have any goals or ambitions in life. I remember at one point I wanted to be a teacher, but I realized that you have to take this test. I think it's called the Praxis. I'm not sure, but you had to take this big test, and I was like, I'm not going to take this test. I'm just not going to do it. So I knew something. I don't know what that is. I'm not doing it. I'm not working hard. You know, I remember I took the SATs, And I felt like, I don't know if anyone's ever seen the show Shameless, but there's this guy on there, his name is Lip, and he's a genius. And I was like, Shameless wasn't out at this point, but this is how I had it in my mind. I was like, I'm going to take the SATs, I'm going to do amazing, and I'm going to be the person that didn't even try and got like a 1600. That is not what happened. I got a 900. You get like a 600 for writing your name. I at one point just started like making patterns on the test, you know. So Frostburg was the only place that I got in. And I had previously gone up there to visit a friend of mine. And when I was there, we had gotten kicked out of a frat party. And I was driving somewhere. I was following them somewhere, but I was drunk and I went the wrong way down a one-way street. And the car coming the right way was a cop. And, of course, he stopped me. And, you know, I begged and cried my way out of a DUI that night. But, you know, and I got this alcohol citation. My dad kind of took care of that. But I remember being like, feeling like, oh, man, when I come up here, like, there's just kind of this, like, ominous warning. I like how Bill says, like, in the book, ominous warning, which I failed to heed. And I feel like I obviously didn't go to war, but that's how I relate it to my story is, like, I knew, you know, the second I went up there, it's kind of like, in a way, my mom's a little bit of, like, a FBI agent. She's not really, but, like, she should be when it comes to her kids. And when I would go missing, she would pull out the phone bill and try to call people. And, you know, when I went away, I didn't have any of that. So, you know, and I don't know how she didn't know I was doing what I was doing before. I really have no idea, but we'll just, I don't know. But I went off to school, and there was just no holds bar. And literally within, like, I think my first 2 weeks there, I got into a physical fight with a girl across the hall who lived across the hall from me in my apartment building. I got my second restraining order against me and then was kind of immediately known as this, like, crazy drunk girl that smoked a lot of cigarettes. And because of the restraining order, I had to move from one end of the apartment building to the other end of the apartment building, and I actually would end up keep having to move because roommates couldn't deal with me. I mean, I would get so drunk, I would, you know, physically cut myself. It was really bad. Just kind of a pathetic cry for help looking back at it. But I was just so, I was so, I don't know, I just had like this horrible soul sickness that just kept getting worse and worse and worse, to be honest. And, you know, I would drink a lot by myself. I mean, I feel like my first semester there, I barely remember drinking with anybody. I know I did, but, like, I even remember thinking one time, I was like, well, my roommate was in her room. Like, that's not really drinking by yourself, but it is. you know, and I felt like if I switched from vodka to boxed wine, like, that would help me control my actions a little bit because I would, you know, do things that I feel like a lot of alcoholic women would relate to. I'm not going to go into them, you know, but I felt like I would feel not very good about that and then would kind of get used to it, you know, but I could not control my actions when I drank. I feel like that's almost why I started to love drugs a little bit more. Not a little bit more, but, like, I felt like when you do cocaine, like, I it was something much more desperate about it, but at least I could, like, control my actions, you know. I wouldn't leave the seat, you know, but so that was, you know, that was what was happening. I could not in any way, shape, or form show up for anything. I remember I would try to get on the bus so hungover, and I would just have to have the bus, like, the apartment building that where I was at, they had a shuttle that would take you to campus because it was at the end of campus. And I would just have the bus driver, like, pull over so I could throw up and then just take me back, you know. And I felt like if I could make my next semester classes start at, like, 11 or noon, my hangover would be gone by then. I'd be able to show up, you know. And that's, you know, that's not what happened. It just kind of got worse and worse and worse. And I ended up trying to kill myself. I kept trying to stop drinking, and I couldn't, you know. I remember one time, you know, in More About Alcoholism, it talks about the insanity that precedes the first drink. And it talks about the guy that puts whiskey in his milk, and I put vodka in my Slurpee. It is exactly what happened to me. I, you know, after a very long night, came home at about 7 or 8 in the morning, no sleep, desperately trying to sleep and not being able to, kind of pacing back and forth, telling myself what a loser I was. And I said to myself, I'm never going to drink ever again. I'm never going to do drugs ever again. This is done. And, you know, I think eventually I was able to take a nap. I went with my roommate somewhere, and we walked by the baseball field. And I remember seeing a bunch of people and feeling overwhelmed. And my first thought was, these thoughts weren't connected, but it was like, feel uncomfortable. And then second thought was, drink. And then I said, nope, we said we're not doing that anymore. And then I went to 7-Eleven, and I got a cherry Slurpee, and I looked at the Slurpee, and I was like, ooh, vodka would be great in this. And I kid you not, I remember looking down and realizing that I remember, you know, dropping my makeup compact, and someone saying like, oh, Rachel's drunk, and I felt like, how did that happen? And then I felt like, okay, I will try again tomorrow. And I obviously, you know, didn't drink long enough for that to happen every day for years, but I drank long enough for that to happen for me to be very aware of the fact that I could in no way, shape, or form control what I was doing. I feel like with alcoholism, you kind of see, like, everything is normal, and to an extent, I absolutely had that, but when I tried to stop drinking and couldn't, I was like, I am insane. Like, I can't believe that I can't stop doing this. And then one day I ended up trying to kill myself because I'm dramatic. It was very spontaneous, but I took a lot of pills. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I don't necessarily know about funny, but I feel like it goes against, like, all human instinct to do something like that. Because I remember, like, my experience was after having done that, knowing my motive, knowing what was going to happen, I couldn't go to sleep. It was adrenaline. I could not go to sleep. And I feel like that is your body telling you no. And then when the ambulance finally came, because somebody had called me and I told them what I was doing, and they called the cops, or they called 911, I remember that was when I was like, okay. They could not keep me. They could barely keep me awake. They kept having to, like, knuckle me right here. And I had to drink the charcoal. It's just gross. I would get very belligerent with the nursing staff. And when I got out of there, my mom should be an FBI agent, because I didn't tell a soul I was in this hospital. Nobody. I don't know how she found me, but one day, like, you have to be in there for 72 hours when you try to kill yourself. It's the law. I hate that law. I have don't fence me in syndrome. I hate being in the hospital. I don't like when people try to control my, people try to control my actions, or, you know, I couldn't drink in there. They wouldn't let me smoke my cigarettes. I hated that. And all of a sudden I just was like walking out of something, and, there was my mom and my dad, and they were like, get your stuff. We're leaving. We packed up a very small bag of things. I guess they later on went out and got everything out, and I came back home. I came home, and my last month of drinking, I kept drinking when I got back. I went into an inpatient rehab. I was supposed to be in there for 28 days. I walked out after three. Had, you know, this 30-year-old guy that I would smoke crack with come and pick me up. You know, also being 18 and doing smoking crack with 30-year-old men doesn't really bode well for what's happening in your life. It was actually very demoralizing when I think about it, and certain things that happen. But I had again gotten fired from another restaurant job. I had gotten this medical withdrawal from school, I ended up in the hospital again. I had actually gone to the hospital another time in this month and a half. It all kind of boiled down to, like, three times in the hospital in a month and a half. You know, there had been this kind of spontaneous intervention between a couple of friends and my family. At this point, nobody really wanted anything to do with me. And I remember, like, my friends from school, a lot of them were from, they grew up around here, and they would not drink with me. And I felt so mad about that. I was like, I can't believe that you were not going to drink with me. I thought you guys were doing exactly what I was doing. And I felt like I'm just the easy scapegoat. I was just so angry. I couldn't understand why they wouldn't drink with me anymore. But everybody wasn't drinking with me anymore. My friends from home, my friends from school, my parents, like, nobody was like, you should be drinking. And how I ended up coming into AA was I was picked up off the side of a road in Gaithersburg from the two friends that I had left. They took me to the hospital. on the way to the hospital, I saw somebody from my high school that I didn't like, and I started screaming obscenities at her. Please keep in mind, I'm going to the hospital because of drinking and drugs, by the way. So I was a mess. I hadn't showered. I was crying. I was sweaty. It was really bad. I looked like a newcomer. You know, I looked like somebody who was dying of alcoholism. And, in the car, my friend was like, why are you yelling at her? Like, she didn't do anything. Like, I'm taking you to the hospital. And then I started to yell at her and tell her everything that was wrong with her. So when I got to the hospital, they just dropped me off. They didn't stick around. They didn't want anything to do with me. They just dropped me off. And the emergency room staff or somebody took a look at me, and they didn't make me wait to get in there. They kind of plopped me on a couch, and I, like, made my way from the couch to the middle of the emergency room floor. And was hysterical, telling anybody who would listen that I ruined my life because of my drinking and my drug use. And I remember I called my mom, and I will never pretend to understand the love a parent has for a child, but I called her, and she said that she wasn't going to come to the hospital. And there's something about, and she, you know, said, like, if this is what you want to do, and she was crying, she said, if this is what you want to do, you do this, but we're not going to be a part of it. And there's something about knowing that no one's coming to bail you out that just made me feel so low. And, you know, I was actually with the woman who found me, and she told me that there was a lot more cursing and belligerence in this story than I remember. apparently she was like, you were like cussing out the nurses and all this stuff. I was like, I don't remember this, but I remember feeling so low. It's like what the book talks about, like the gates of hell had closed in on me. And I said again to myself, I was like, I am going to stop doing all of this. And then something in the back of my head was like, no, you're not. You have tried that and you have not been able to do it. And I said a prayer. I was like, God, you better help me or kill me, because I cannot do this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. And there was a belligerence to that prayer, to be honest. It was certainly desperate, but there was also like, you better do something. And two members of Alcoholics Anonymous were in the hospital. It was a mother and a daughter. They were there because the mother thought her appendix was going to burst. But they wrote me a note, and the note just said, we're in AA, we're sober, here's a list of meetings, here's our numbers, you never have to live this way ever again. And they gave me the note, and I don't even know how I was able to read it, but I remember looking at it and being like, I don't need AA. Like, I can't believe you're giving this to me. But I politely said thank you. And then the doctor sat me down, and he was just like, you're freaking out a little bit. We're going to give you a pill. And I was like, thank God this guy gets it. And I don't remember anything for the next, I think it was 4 days. I can't remember. When I got out, I didn't know what day of the week it was. I had no idea. But when I got out of the hospital, I gave those people a call. And, you know, I went to my first AA meeting, and like I had said before, my first night out, I went to an AA meeting, and I had the reaction that I had, which was, I'm very glad that you all are here. I went to AA, and I felt like, I remember really relating to what people said, but it wasn't until my first sponsor got me in a car and 12-stepped me, which that was a Sunday night when I went to my first AA meeting. And then I asked her to sponsor me at that meeting. And then I canceled on her for her picking me up for a meeting the next day, but she picked me up on Tuesday. And I think about what she did, because she just called me and she was like, what's your address? I'm going to be at your house. And I wonder, I'm like, I don't know if I would still be sober if she hadn't done it in that way, you know. She just said, I'm going to be there. This is the time I'm going to pick you up. And I don't really remember being all excited to go to another AA meeting. And if she hadn't called, I certainly wasn't going to make the initiative to go, but she did. And when she got me in the car, she started to tell me about alcoholism. She started to share her experience, and she actually shared something this doesn't make me alcoholic. It doesn't make her alcoholic. But it was probably my deepest secret that I had at the time, and she shared that. She shared that she had made up a rape story and put somebody in jail. And my first thought to that was like, you're a sick person. And then I realized, like, I would literally get drunk and say that. I would lie about that. I would actually lie about a ton of things. I am such a liar. I lie about the things that you're not supposed to lie about. You know, I am a horrible liar. you know, I didn't say anything about that. And obviously, of course, she started telling me also about, you know, the phenomenon of craving, and she started telling me about that stuff, but, and of course I related. It was exactly like what they talk about, what happens when an alcoholic talks to another alcoholic. It was like trying to pull teeth, getting me to talk, and then when she started to share her story, I was telling her things that I hadn't told anybody. I felt like the puzzle pieces were coming together. It was like the lines were crossing. I was like not able to shut up about my experience, you know. And I think for the first, I remember at the end of the night after her taking me to a meeting, I remember she was so kind too. She bought me a Starbucks, and not many people were buying me anything. And, you know, obviously no one wanted anything to do with me, and I said that, and I had felt so alone. So like that little act of kindness, really meant a lot to me. And she, she took me to my first meeting, and then at the end of the night, she's like, so do you feel a little bit of hope? And I was almost like too cool for school to say that out loud and express how I had really felt. But I did feel that. I was like, yeah, a little bit, you know, maybe. But on the inside, I did feel like that. I was like, maybe, just maybe, you know, like, this is probably not going to work, and I kind of hate you all, but maybe, you know. I was not pleased to be in AA, by the way. I feel like there's some people that come in, and they're so excited, and they're like, yeah, let's do this. And I was like, I can't believe that I'm here. Please, somebody kill me. I don't want to do this. You know, but that was the first time that I had felt like, okay. But there, you know, I did drink a couple of times after that. I would get drunk and then go to meetings. You know, I don't think I had any substantial amount of time to call it a significant relapse or anything, you know. And the last time that I drank, my first sponsor had me say the third step prayer drunk in her driveway. And I really, truly feel like the insanity that it talks about and more about alcoholism had me by the kahunas. Like, I can't say enough how much I couldn't stop drinking. Like, I really mean that. I know that some people might look at me and think, you're young, you don't know what you're talking about, but I know, and I could not stop drinking. And I look back on this incident where she had me say the third step prayer, and it was kind of like, and I see this in hindsight, you know, it's not like a great, wonderful flood of, like, feelings came over me. But after that, that was, you know, my sobriety date. And I feel like my mind kind of did this 180 where I became terrified to ever drink ever again. I mean, really, really, really very afraid. I was very afraid of where I was going to go back to and, you know, how much worse it could get. I was terrified. But I was not willing to do what people told me. You know, I was willing to go to meetings. I was willing to hang out with people. I am from a young people's group, so obviously there's a lot of young people doing a lot of young people things. And, you know, that I was like, I will do this. And I have a very short string. You know, like, I remember I would see people meditating, and I would just think, I was like, I will never do that. Like, I will never, like, my sponsor told me to write a 4-step. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, I am not going to do this, you know. And, like, I would outwardly say, I am not going to do this. And that's very frustrating for somebody who's trying to work with you. And I ended up getting into a fight with my sponsor, and I left my home group and tried to kill myself. And you know you're crazy when you get arrested in front of a 3-year-old and taken to the psych ward. I don't assume if you could call it arrest, but they did handcuff me and throw me in the back of a cop car. And I was taken to the psych ward because I tried to kill myself. Cops don't like it when you call them names and get very mad at them. So in the psych ward, this story has a purpose other than being crazy, I promise. but in the psych ward, I called the person. It was the woman who, 3-year-old, she had her 3-year-old, she had come over, and she had her 3-year-old, and she had called me the next day in the psych ward. And I was arguing with her about how I was right. And she stopped in the middle of the argument, and she just said, look, I am at work right now. You are in the psych ward. If you can't see that you're wrong, I can't help you. And I paused. And I feel like, I even remember thinking, like, I up until this point had not listened to anybody. It was almost like an over, I feel like instincts in moderation are maybe okay. I don't know, but there was a pride there that was excessive, and a belligerence there that was excessive, and I'm not going to listen to you that was excessive. And this is probably the first surrender I had ever had. That it was so profound, and I just remember saying to her, I was like pausing and being like, okay, what do you want me to do? And she wasn't my sponsor. She was just a friend. And she was like, why don't you go into your room and pray? And I went into my psych ward room with my little psych ward jammies, and there was a big book there. I don't know if somebody had put it there, if it had been there, I hadn't noticed it, but I picked it up, and I found myself in the book. I just remember I would just choose a page, and I was like, I've related so much, you know, and I read a lot that day, and I related to a lot that day, but there was this one, there's these two paragraphs in the fifth step where it talks about having a reputation that you know in your heart you don't deserve, and, you know, shuddering to think that somebody sees that and when you're drunk, and then that makes for more drinking. And I couldn't put it a better way. I related to that more than I had ever related to anything in my entire life. I called my sponsor and I was like, just tell me, I will, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. And she was like, play the game and just get out of there. So I played the game, got out of there, if somebody had told me to jump off the Bay Bridge at that moment, I probably would have done it. Obviously, no one's going to tell you that in AA, but that was how willing I was, you know. And I did my fourth step. I did it very quickly, which is funny. That's actually, I recently got a new sponsor, like very recently, probably in like the end of May. And I have had the same sponsor for so long. So I had this first sponsor, and then I had my next sponsor for about 10 years, who was her grand sponsor. And she got me when I was pretty new, so we didn't redo a four step. And I had her for so long, this was the only four step I had ever done. And my new sponsor now is like, I can't believe you've only done one four step. Like, get, you know, we're reworking the steps. And I'm actually in the middle of writing my four step right now. It's taking forever. not because I'm not doing it. I was doing it all weekend. It's just a lot of things go on in the head that you have to, writing is tough. And I mean tough in the sense of like my hand will hurt after. But, you know, I did my four step, and I read it to her. I read my fifth step to her, and I don't think that I had any kind of like profound experience or anything. I just felt like, I did this, whatever, like tell me what to do next. She had me sit, and for the hour, I fell asleep. I remember like at the end, I said the seven step prayer, and I felt like, oh, phew, I was just the girl in the psych ward, and now I'm on the seventh step. Like, this is great, you know, and that's not at all how that works, but that was my first thought in my mind, you know. I feel like I did whatever anybody told me to do, and I was so busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have, like, three, I would pack my car with newcomers. I had a bunch of service. I would go from one meeting and do the coffee and then go speak at a H&I commitment and then go to another meeting. Like, I was running around like a chicken with my head cut off, really. And maybe that was what I needed at the time, but I'm really glad for my second sponsor who, you know, told me to do something, do one thing thoroughly, than to do a bunch of things. I don't think you can cuss at this meeting, but I think you get what I'm trying to say. I'm really glad that she told me that, and I feel like another defect of mine was trying to do all of this service so I could look good in AA, and she gave me the direction to do the stuff that nobody sees, and just try to be one among many, and I did that with her. I, you know, wrote out my ASAP, and I feel like when I did my four step, I was just, I don't even know if I've heard it referred to in AA as like just reading a story. I just thought like, here, this is what it is. I was a little afraid to read it. Here it is. Whatever, you know. When I wrote my ASAP, it was, it was probably the first time I had kind of felt like, you know, I was such a victim. And when I would drink, it was everybody else's fault, and it was especially my dad's fault, and it was sex tape guy's fault, because there was a lot of stuff that had also gone on between those two people as well. And after doing my four-step, with certain, I mean, I think that certain resentments might take longer than others, but for the most part, I was really able to see, you know, where I had, over time, I was able to see where I had caused harm or where I had started the ball rolling in certain situations. And I, again, didn't have a profound experience when I wrote my ASAP or honestly when I did my nine-step amends. I feel like I can be an excellent storyteller and twist things and make them sound really dramatic, but that's not my experience, you know. I feel like when I did my eighth and ninth step, my second sponsor said to me, you know, don't tell anybody that you're doing these. The only person who should hear about this is the newcomer. And I know what she meant by that. She meant, you know, and it wasn't necessarily to tell the newcomer. It was, you know, whatever effect I was getting from it, it should be transmitted to the newcomer. And, you know, I went out and I made amends. And I remember, you know, the first girl that got the restraining order against me, like, I would drive by her house and I would feel like, I hate you. Not even necessarily I hate you, but it was just like I would always feel so uncomfortable driving by there. And I made amends to her. And, you know, there's no ill will there, you know, which is really I remember being new and being very afraid to go to public places because I was going to see people, and I could have lived my life not making amends. I did them, and I did them without complaint because I had a solid first step, but I really could have hidden in AA for my whole life. And I feel like I don't really have that now. And with, you know, the girl who got the second restraining order against me, I called her, and she – I actually got a hold of her mom, and her mom said, you know, I don't think she's going to want to talk to you, but I'll tell her. And she didn't call, you know. And I feel like that actually happened with a lot of people that I tried to reach out to. Many of them did not want anything to do with me. I made amends to a couple of roommates. One of the amends went pretty well. Another girl, the things that I would say and do to her were extremely cruel. And I could tell that she was still upset about it. And I think a part of that had to do with me, and the other part had to do with what she was going through and how she was doing, and also her insecurities. But I could tell when I left, I was like, that, you know, that she will probably never fully forgive me, you know. And, you know, I have about 5 minutes left, so I also wanted to share about the amends with my family. Because I feel like that's really important, too, and there's no human being on earth who cared more about me and who cares more about me, my sobriety, anything than my mom. No one is more happy that I'm sober than my mom. And, you know, my sponsor, you know, really was the one to tell me, you know, you need to not necessarily, like, go up and make amends and then just have everything be fine. You need to be different with them. And you need to do these, what they dub living amends. So I would have to show up. I would have to, you know, help. I would have to help do the dishes, which I know is sad. I would never do that. I would never do that. Such a spoiled brat, you know. And I would have to show up and be where I said I was going to be. I also am. I will yell. I have no way of dealing with things. I mean, I do, obviously, but, like, my natural instinct is to yell because I'm afraid. Then I had to stop doing that, you know. And then I was able to eventually make direct amends to both her and my dad. And my relationship with my mom is so wonderful. I love her. She loves me. The only thing that ever stood in the way of that relationship was my selfishness and my drinking, to be honest. With my dad, it's a little bit more complicated. He is my dad. And he is sometimes not the nicest person in the world. And I would get very mad when I would hear people share in AA that, you know, they made amends to their dad or whatever parent they didn't get along with, and then all of a sudden they had this amazing relationship. And that wasn't my experience. I tried to make, like, this regular plan with him. He was not interested. And, you know, and my parents are still together, but that's just who he is. And I, you know, my sponsor was like, you know, you have to accept him for who he is and just be a daughter when he wants you to be. And to be rigorously honest, I feel like I did that for a little bit, and then I just got so mad at him for a lot of other things. You know, he treats my mom in a way that I don't like, and I will try to stand up for her, and that causes more problems. you know, to the point where my mom has had to be like, I'm happy, you know, you, and you don't need to do this. You know, and I feel like I just kind of, I lavish my mom with attention, but, you know, with my dad, I'm just like, whatever, you know, to the point where he would be in the hospital because, I mean, he has such bad health problems. And I remember one time he had a stroke and he held my hand. I was like, get off of me, you know. You know, I've really had to take a look at that, you know, and kind of accept, like, he is who he is. And it's gotten a little better, but it will never be that way, you know. Because that's not the kind of person that he is. But that doesn't mean that I get to go and act like a jerk to him, which is what I feel is like the justified response. And that's not how that works. And I also want to share a little bit of like what it's like now. And I feel like my last couple months have been, I feel like everybody says this, so like my last couple months have been a little tough. So I'm going to, I'm going to hop on that bandwagon. You know, I was in a relationship. I was engaged. I was supposed to get married last week, and I left about 2 months ago. It was not working out. I have always really struggled with a God. I've never doubted that there is, I mean, in a way I kind of have, like, you know, but I think my big thing is I think a God is punishing. And that has ebbed and flowed throughout my sobriety. And my sponsor has this really, you know, I kind of felt like all I ever wanted was to get married, and now, like, this happened and it didn't work out. And it didn't work out because I chose that. But trust me, if you had seen a video of what the house was like, you would have been like, get out of there too. There were a lot of things that were not okay on both sides. And I have, you know, there's a lot of work to do on my end. I'm certainly not perfect, and that's a little embarrassing to say, but it's true. You know, and I, you know, very shortly before that got my current sponsor, and she has this relationship with a God that's so, you know how you hear people say, like, I'm in a love affair with God, or like, God, I know God loves me so much and I love him so much. I have always looked at those people and just been like, shut up. Like, you know, you're just as miserable as the rest of us, you know? And I kind of felt like that will never be me. There is no way I could put love of a God before the things that I worship that are on the outside. There's no way I could put a love of a God before a career, before my desperate attempts to get whatever outside thing that I want. And I have been in a spot recently of seeking and really trying to, you know, whatever that looks like. I have found that I really like reading about people's experiences who doubted. And, you know, not necessarily reading, like, you know, I remember one time I tried to read Carl Jung's Varieties of Spiritual Experiences, and I, like, could not understand what they were talking about. I read, like, two pages. I was like, this is too dense. I can't get into this, you know. So it wasn't necessarily, it's not necessarily stuff like that. It's more like reading about people who have been in pain, you know, like Mother Teresa, like people who have been in pain, or the woman who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, you know, it's like the standard, like, I just didn't get married book, you know, but, you know, people who, you know, are in pain and are seeking, and they know that their only option is a God. And I feel like there's kind of been this grappling of, you know, knowing that that is what I need, and a lot of old ideas that I have about higher power and about a God. And I, you know, I don't want to say that, I don't know if that process will ever be complete. If it is, I mean, I'm probably in a bad spot if it is. But, you know, I do feel like the outside things were, in a way, stripped. You know, like I had this beautiful apartment in Tysons that I shared with my fiance, you know, and I am in my parents' basement, you know, paying off a wedding that's not happening, you know, and it's a lot of money. Oh, my God. Jeez. You know, I'm going to be there for a couple months. It's quite sad. But, you know, I feel like those things were, I don't want to necessarily say stripped, because I do feel like I had been battling with it for, like, what to do about that situation for a little bit. And, you know, I feel like I got almost like, it was like every cell in my body was like, you can leave now, you should go. And I almost feel like that was a God moment. But there's still a deep sadness there about something like that. I'm out of time. I've gone over a little bit. I'm sorry about that. But thank you very much, Sam, again, for having me out here. And thank you for letting me share. I hope you got something out of that. And if you didn't, please keep coming back. So.